Hello and welcome back to another edition of Editing Aloud. And it's I've been away for a week or two, and it's been an absolutely crazy time. I arrived home today or yesterday to find that Trevor Manuel is back as an investment driver. Arthur Fraser is no longer the head of intelligence. He's now the head of prisons, which he might have an incentive to really make quite comfortable while he's there. A dinner that I was going to have has had to be cancelled tonight because one of the attendees has gone off with Cyril Ramaphosa to London. Mark Lamberti has stepped down from all his positions now, including his day job. And everything is moving so quickly in this country. But if there were a clock ticking, one of those atomic clocks ticking, that, you know, how many minutes to midnight are we? It would have to be Sikonati for KPMG, one of the four big auditing firms in this country and in the world. It has just lost all government business, as I understand it, right? It's been pulled by the Auditor General. It's losing directors and reputation left, right and center. How do you stop a mess like this?
Absolutely. Kimi Makwetu pulled the plug last night. He said any audit work. So if you want, for example, a report to fire me and you want KPMG to justify that, they can still do that, even if in government. But if there's work that needs the audit opinion of the Auditor General, it's gone. Now that means Eskom, where they got about 120 million rands last year as an audit fee, Transnet, South African Airways, anything that has a government shareholding, KPMG, that's gone. That is because, of course, KPMG has dug its own hole.
But what's the sort of so what paragraph there? I mean, if KPMG goes down, what does it mean?
Let's not jump there. Why must KPMG go down? It really must. The auditor should be the last.
It really must go down. You
it
think
really
it
must
yeah.
go down.
Okay.
It really must die.
Yeah.
The auditor should be the last line of defense for the investor. When an auditor comes to you and say, these guys have got 2.8 billion rand in cash in the bank, and their name is VBS Mutual Bank or Eskom, they've got what they say they do. If you can't trust the auditor, there's nobody you can trust. And that is why it must go down.
But isn't that a problem? Isn't that becoming a problem industry-wide in South Africa? I mean, that the auditing profession has now been found to be wanting in terms of its integrity. Surely there are good, solid people inside KPMG and good, solid people inside all of these companies.
Indeed, a big number of the people who work at KPMG are really hard-working, honest professionals. However, the leadership has inculcated a culture where the partner that brings in the most fees is the most important. And this now you see the downside of that when SARS, for example, emails you and says, this is the finding you must make. You just copy and paste the thing and charge 23 million rands. And
don't speak to the accused.
Don't speak to the accused. Mm. Corruption flourishes. You get rid of a sitting finance minister, a deputy finance minister. You get rid of the top 55 people at SARS. The result to society is a net cost of 55 billion rand revenue collection shortfall. The country becomes a haven for corruption. It's a free for all because the people whose professional stamp makes all the difference have just been sequestered.
So I just want to ask, but let me just come back now. So KPMG goes down. Everyone gets a terrible fright. Why does it matter that they, not why should they, but what will be the result of them going down? How will it affect business and the economy?
The hope is that that will then help start a clean-up exercise and make the auditing profession what it should be. And those that are left behind, know exactly what does happen. Of course, it has happened in the past. KPMG itself swallowed up what was the remnants of Arthur Andersen, but that it doesn't. It seems like the culture has not changed much. We will have to start all over again every 20, 30 years or so.
Ron, that's how the capital works. If you were faced with this issue, right? Yeah. So it goes down. Mm. You've got other people to clean up. How do you decide? Well, where do you start? How do you make sure that when somebody comes and asks an auditor in South Africa for an opinion about a company he wants to or she wants to buy, that the opinion is that if not, that the opinion is going to be an honest one?
Yeah, I mean that's the whole thing about KPMG, and just the whole trust notion when it comes to auditing firms has gone out the window. And I think when KPMG's collapsed, that's about 3,500 odd professionals without a job. So in that case, so now we're going to rely on only three, like Deloitte and the other two. So I guess the feeling there is the cost of doing business in South Africa will shoot up. I guess if you want like some economic cost to KPMG falling, is the cost of business going
but
up?
But could the South good Africa guys in KPMG not form their own auditing company and pick up some of their old clients?
But KPMG in particular is important for the top four banks, and they need KPMG for its international link. So that's the importance of KPMG. So even if they went to all these 2,500 employees and started their own audit profession, they'll still need that international leg, which is what the advantage was with KPMG. So if KPMG SA closes tomorrow, that's when the banks will be in a bit of a bind. They'll have to rely on only three auditing firms to do their books.
Yeah.
And that feeds in again to, I guess, the cost of doing business in South Africa. Just that it'll add that premium of almost the corruption premium of operating in South Africa.
Well, I was going to ask. Mpumelelo Mkabela, you of this, formerly of this house, welcome back. This is the political result of all of this. Mm-hmm. Of what looked like to be a series of disastrous business decisions, the political stuff that comes out at the end is dire, because it starts with a political problem, Jacob Zuma's corruption basically, and it ends up via all these channels giving someone like Cyril Ramaphosa a problem.
Well, but there's something good about it at the end of the day. One is that we have a central bank that has got a strong regulatory mechanism to watch what's happening in the banking sector, which is where the rot of KPMG, insofar as VBS is concerned, was actually unearthed. The second reason why we should find something positive about this is that the Auditor General now, as Sikonati points out, has decided to kick out KPMG from all government work. And this is not just about auditing state-owned companies. It's auditing government departments, municipal work. There's a lot of work that auditing firms, private, they do, which is signed off by the Auditor General. Yeah. Of course, you never knew who was behind this audit. All you read is a report of the Auditor General signed by him. But he knows exactly which audits have been done by KPMG. Yeah. And he knows the extent of the work. And now that KPMG announced that it was to go back to files that date back to, you know, a couple of years back and all of that, the Auditor General realizes that a lot of governments, what might have appeared to be clean audits, could themselves be actually questionable.
Yeah.
So politically, that is a problem, because these things go to Parliament, these reports, and they are approved by Parliament on our behalf as citizens. So what that means basically is that there's a real possibility that a lot of clean audits of what was regarded as clean audits by KPMG may have been influenced. Who knows? Now there's a dark cloud about the state of public finances in South Africa in general, or at least the part that was looked at by KPMG.
Is there not a case, though, then, for bringing in some form of investigative service? And I'm not thinking necessarily about the Scorpions, but something like that, an FBI type of unit. No, because it would work. The FBI works for the Justice Department, but very closely with the tax authorities in the States. And where you could actually police this stuff. So we need people to visibly going to jail.
To police the auditors.
So that becomes frightening. Mm. So it becomes frightening to lie.
But the reason why you are saying that is the other point that you are not making.
Yeah.
Which is that we actually don't have a competent state agency that can look at these kinds of crimes, because yeah. these are very sophisticated sophisticated crimes.
Mm. But universities are full of young, bright kids in law school who could come out of law school and they would die for an opportunity to work for a well-led, you know, unit that went out and basically killed corruption in this country. I mean, you've got 100 of those guys, whoever they are, led by whoever, and there's no end of leadership available here. We know this. Under a proper legal structure, they can't be politically interfered with. You know, no one's above the law, etc., etc., etc. And they just go for it.
Yeah,
that's our problem with our justice system, right? We have these politicians deciding who's at the helm. So even if you create this body, this awesome body, you create like a Scorpio, whatever. The point is, there'll be a politician at the end of the day who deciding where their head is and influencing what is investigated and what isn't. And I think that goes back to the fundamental question about our investigative authorities.
But here's a point that I want to correct before we move on. Ron correctly pointed out that KPMG is one of the big four auditors that audit the banks, and their demise, which should happen, would raise the cost of doing business. What he did not say is that the Reserve Bank, through that mechanism that Mpumi spoke about of supervising the banks, through the Banks Act, has to approve the auditor of a bank. Mm. And traditionally, it has always approved the big four, Deloitte, KPMG, EY, and PricewaterhouseCoopers. The banks got lazy and did not try to get other auditors. We've got Grant Thornton as an international firm. We've got PKF. These have got all the international links that Ron spoke about.
Yeah.
But because the Reserve Bank has only ever approved this big four to audit the banks, no one bothered to check those. It's not that they
Why
do not
does it
have
do
the
that?
Capacity.
I mean, surely the Reserve Bank is smart enough to have a conversation every now and again about
this is
stability, I guess. And this
not
feeds
only
into
that,
stability, right?
Not only that, this comes all the way from a closed banking system of South Africa before 1994, where tradition mattered. We should be able to break away from that. I repeat again, and I've said it on this show, PKF, Grant Thornton are as big and better.
Do they have as many employees as KPMG SA? Do they have the capacity?
You first get the contract and you get the capacity.
I mean, now they have the capacity. There's 3,500 people out of
jobs.
If KPMG
exactly.
is old, they can
So if you go to, exactly, we agree. If you now award the contract to audit Standard Bank, which is, by the way, audited by KPMG.
And there's two.
And NetBank.
And
APSA. If you take that contract and say, Grant Thornton, you've got all the international links that Barclays needs, you've got everything, there you go. They take immediately the good people from KPMG.
Yeah.
They all went to the same accounting schools and qualified the same. Here's the job to do under a different brand, same
But for a country having one of its big auditing firms collapse. What does it say about the cost of what does it say about the country South Africa?
The very point I am making is that you have that big four because the Reserve Bank created that big four.
Mm.
When the Reserve Bank moves on,
to the Reserve Bank, and well, to you guys as well. I mean, the notion that these four big four need breaking up internationally is spoken about more and more. That they are too big.
This audit versus opinion job, like splitting them.
And splitting them is like what the Dodd-Frank Act did in the U.S. If you are an asset manager, if you are a broker, you only trade for your client's account.
Yeah.
If you want to trade for, that's exactly what should happen here. If you want to get into the consulting business of offering opinions, then that's a separate job,
business,
line of work from audit.
Okay.
That's what should happen.
We'll carry on this conversation after this message. Welcome back. I see on the front page of Business Day today, the IMF delivers SA a vote of confidence, and it's increased its growth forecasts. And I was just made me wonder a little bit about what sort of a first 100 days President Cyril Ramaphosa is having, and they're not bad, actually. I tweeted something yesterday. I can't remember how many people he's got rid of. Obviously, Tom Moyane's gone. Jacob Zuma's on trial. We've escaped downgrading from Moody's. The good news just keeps coming. Arthur Fraser is no longer the Director General of Intelligence. One doesn't know whether it's Cyril plotting there, whether, okay, now today we're going to do this or whatever. But it's panning out sort of all right at the moment, right? And he's got this sort of investment team. I would send, with each of Trevor Manuel and or Jaco Maree, I'd send a trade unionist, quite frankly. I think, you know, they can't go there and speak up a story without the without some corroboration. Mpumelelo, Cyril's doing okay?
Yeah, he is, but you also in the list should have mentioned the VAT hike, which was certainly not good news.
Yeah.
And that shows that there's still the legacy of Zuma for which we're still paying. And I think we want to be paying for a very long time.
Yeah.
So he inherits that.
Yeah.
But I think it's a good story that he's actually fulfilling his promises. Mm. You remember he announced the new deal in Soweto.
Yeah.
From then, he went on to announce these plans to attract investments during the State of the Nation.
Yeah.
And he's making good out of that, because now he has this top-level team. If you look at their profiles, Jaco Maree, former CEO of Standard Bank, the important thing about him is that during the time when he was CEO of Standard Bank, two things happened. Standard Bank expanded onto the African continent quite aggressively.
Yeah.
And the second thing is that there was this 20% acquisition of
By
the Chinese, a huge investment that came into South Africa.
Mm.
But there was a condition there as part of that deal that Standard Bank will facilitate Chinese investments on the African continent. So that's a plus and a negative. It's a plus in a sense that it got Jaco Maree a lot of contacts on the continent, as well as from Asian investors.
Yeah.
But at the same time, Standard Bank became a part agent of the Chinese in terms of that deal.
Yeah.
So there's a good and a bad out of that. But I think he's experienced enough.
Yeah.
Then you have Trevor Manuel, who's highly regarded.
Yeah.
I don't think there's a point of mentioning too much about him, except that it's interesting that he's referred to as former finance minister in the statement by Cyril Ramaphosa when he appointed him now, which means that he's taken on this task more as a former finance minister than as a former minister and the president.
Yeah.
And interesting, of course, that they work together in the National Planning Commission. So he more or less understands what Cyril Ramaphosa would like to do. But maybe last point, Peter.
Does Trevor not weaken him inside the ANC by choosing Trevor Manuel? I just thought about him.
But it's a kind of within an arm's length thing, isn't it, really?
It's about investor appeasement, really, than ANC domestic politics.
Mm.
So the other thing, Peter, which is my last point that we have to think about, is that I think Ramaphosa is being innovative here in the way he's structuring his presidency, because I think this is for the first time that we have a president who has got investment envoys. Mbeki used to have lots of envoys on security issues on the continent. Zuma also had lots of envoys around the continent, around security issues. So first time Ramaphosa appoints people of repute international. They're about investment, which really says something about his priorities.
I mean, his big test, obviously, Sikonathi, is going to be land, right? I mean, when this parliamentary committee has done its work by August, I think it's got to finish it, then the whole debate will start up again. Do you think he's got a plan?
Definitely, but just one point on Mpumelelo there. Thabo Mbeki had a panel of prominent and eminent economists that
Harvard,
did
all those guys,
yes,
the group.
Of course, the majority of them were foreigners and they didn't live in this country. They came and visited every once in a while to give him some advice. Does he have a plan about land? The major part about that has been achieved, which is to silence the Economic Freedom Front fighters.
Whoa!
On that point,
I don't think they.
You're getting it wrong on the Mbeki one.
Yes.
The Mbeki panel, he had these working groups, and then he had this international investment council or panel. They were not going out there to represent South Africa in the world. They were advising
him
about
him
what's happening
how
in the world.
This was Ricardo
Major
advice. How to fix
this team
economy.
Is South African and is going out there to hunt, as he puts it.
You're absolutely right.
Yes.
A major difference and quite an important one.
Mm.
I concede. Economic Freedom Front and land. Fighters,
let's get the name of the party.
Fighters. EFF. It's called
Economic
EFF.
Freedom
EFF.
Fighters
yes.
and land.
Yes.
Okay. So you put it formally as an. Adopted by Parliament, and you put a committee to work on it. And of course, you get an outcome that you've already determined that.
Yeah.
Listen, comrades, we have under the property clause in the Constitution, section 25, this matter is sorted until such time that we are not able to get land when we want to buy it. We are not having to implement this. As we stand right now, we've got 4,000 commercial farms we took from farmers but have not been able to distribute to black people. Let's get working on that. Then we can, in the public interest, expropriate land. And indeed, we will compensate people, because we are about we are a nation about rights, rights enshrined in the law, property rights.
Now, if you're the Economic Freedom Front, as you've been calling it, what do you do, fighters? What do you do about that? Does that become a bit nice political sort of present that you're given by?
You know, what would be great for EFF, what Ramaphosa should do is bring the elections before August. I think
I agree with you. I thought he was going to do it before September.
Yeah, so it happens then, yeah. And then you go in the land bid as a new president,
yeah.
And hopefully you get a bigger mandate, right?
Yeah.
Then you can have the stick and almost control it. It doesn't hurt you in next year's election, but that's a great ticket that EFF is going to punt.
There's a problem with doing that,
yeah.
Though. I mean, is that if you remember, I think it was William Kiesel, who stood up at the ANC conference in December and said, we're bankrupt.
Yes.
And a bankrupt party can't fight an election.
But now they have a billionaire as the head of the party.
This
I'm sure he can make a plan about this.
The billionaire doesn't give away his money.
But you also shorten his you know, Cyril has a maximum 11 and a half years in office.
Yeah. But this hurts him. If this thing in August starts, right, this conversation starts, then EFF has pushed this populist mandate, and he has to come across there balancing these forces out, and he seems a bit soft on it. And he goes to elections next year. You just give the EFF maybe a whole 6-7 months to play at you and challenge you.
But
and
this
how
is what,
you
this
are
is what will happen, Peter.
It. So it's another thing.
There is no way that committee will report back in August.
Yeah.
He's got to hope so. Yeah, he's got to push that.
It will be pushed back.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah.
But they'll receive all these submissions and they'll say, wow, we didn't expect so much heavy load.
Yes, and then after the elections, right?
Yes.
But one thing about the economic thinking, BRICS is not there. I haven't heard him say much about BRICS, our new president, and even this new panel. And this whole past 10 years, our whole movement was towards the BRICS thing. And you see, BRICS is almost dead and buried when they speak about it. It's shifting
you know
back to the West.
You know this as well as I do, that the past 10 years of BRICS was only hot air.
Yeah, well. Yeah.
Absolutely hot air. Nothing goes. There's nothing.
But there's money in China. We need to. There's
South Africa can get money everywhere and anywhere.
Mm.
And there's cost, there's the cost of money.
Yeah.
The Chinese, the cost of money by the rest of the world, when they see you going east, and with all what you can get away with in the east, versus how do you want to be seen? Do you want the world to see you as an investment destination, or do you want the world to merely see you as an extension of China? The colony,
the lucky thing.
The colonization that you spoke about in the context of Standard Bank earlier. Now, it's great. The Chinese do have the money. What is the cost of that money?
Okay, cool. The lucky thing is that, in fact, he's going to appease. Now, he's playing this international investment roadshow when the West is kind of slowing down growth-wise. So they will be looking for other avenues.
And
there's concerns about it.
Cyril spent quite a lot of time in China soon after he became deputy president.
Deputy president.
He was studying their state-owned...
State-owned enterprises.
Enterprises model when he was supposedly in charge of some group in
another war room or something.
Yeah, some war room or other.
Yeah.
The other story that touched me, and I really, I feel sorry for him and also understand why it happened and that he had to go, is Mark Lamberti. Mm. He's been around a long time.
Mm. He's been around a long time, worked really hard, built up Massmart. People who have known him for longer have always said a thing about his perceived arrogance. Now it has come up, it has come to catch up with him. But not only that, he's living under a dark cloud of racism. And that you cannot shake. And that is a good example of corporate South Africa and its failure to transform. By the way, you should look at my column in the Financial Mail, talking about you read the headline for the people. It's amongst the first pages, the other way.
Oh, sorry, the other way. Sorry,
yes.
We'll go to the start.
Now,
Sikonati
that's what happened.
In trouble, he says on the headline. And the answer is rent a darkie.
Absolutely. Mark Lambeti, and he's on the page as well at the bottom.
Yeah.
Mark Lambeti did exactly the opposite. Tells this lady, a chartered accountant who's more qualified than the white man that he wants to hire, that you're just an employment equity candidate. Guess what? Had Imperial gotten into the kind of trouble that KPMG is, that Steinhoff is, he would have been running to the white, to the black woman to make her chief executive of Imperial Group.
Yeah.
Now, someone has to pay for what has happened. And indeed, his is just an example of what is happening across...
across white business.
Across white business in South Africa.
And it seems to me so obvious. You know, if I was the CEO of a company, I would surround myself with black people.
Mm.
I mean, black women, black guys. I wouldn't be you wouldn't see a white person for... And it's not that they're not around. You know what you're doing. You might have time to help other people understand what your company, what you were doing, but you know, to ignore the advantages, the obvious advantages of diversity around you, is just stupid. It's just absolutely stupid.
You know,
I got taught so much by the black colleagues that I had about the country that I was living in. It was fantastic.
And you know, the thing with Lamberti, and for, I guess, a lesson for all CEOs operating in this country now. This case, say 10, 15 years ago, if this happened, right, 10, 15 years ago, should have gone to court and been like almost handled. But because of social media and all these other pressures, you can't be seen to behave in this way. And Lamberti, of course, is big name, big brand name, big CEO in this country. It takes, Imperial goes with it. So it's almost how you have to behave as this.
The
spotlight's on you.
There's a new ethics. There's a new ethos.
A new ethos.
It's a new world.
People know immediately. Now it hits them. It's just... So how he reacted to it, I mean, people are saying his lawyers let him down, that he should have spoken about it. Whichever way it played out, it is a huge lesson to any CEO operating in South Africa, in this environment, globally, everywhere, environment.
Do you remember the terribly embarrassing interview with the headmaster of St. John's College?
Yeah, exactly.
On the radio.
Exactly.
You know, where you just can't speak.
Yeah.
You know, Peter, my problem with the Lambeti story is that, well, it's well and good that he's resigning, and you know, we see a lot of people resisting the idea of resigning when they're caught out.
Yeah.
But he's done the right thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
He resigned.
Right,
and of course, under pressure. He's resigned under pressure, not willing. But there's something we're missing here. The debate is being personalized around him and the black chartered accountant that deprived to promote because of whatever.
Yeah.
But we're not debating the policy of affirmative action that has been put under disrepute in this context.
Yeah.
And I think that's, and we're failing there. It seems to me that
I'm going to have to stop you there. Affirmative action is a subject definitely for another show.
Mm.
Is it implemented properly? Is it not implemented properly? We'll talk about it. Thank you for joining us. We'll see you next week.